Welcome to Tangible Remnants, the podcast that makes adaptive reuse exciting, accessible, and sustainable for every building owner. I'm Nikita Reed, an architect and a champion of reusing existing buildings. I'm excited that you're here, so let's get into it. Welcome back. This week's episode is going to be a solo episode where I'll talk through the typical design phases of an architectural project. Because while every adaptive reuse project is unique, the design process is the same. There are typical processes that need to be followed to make sure that things get done in the right order. And so I'm going to give you an overview of the phases and answer some of the questions that I typically get throughout the process when working with a first-time client. Before I jump in, reminder to check the show notes for resources and to sign up for our newsletter to get tips and resources right to your inbox. One of the resources that will be in the show notes for this episode is a best practice guide from the American Institute of Architects. It highlights the definitions of the various design phases, which are based on the AIA contract documents, as well as editions of the Architect's Handbook for Professional Practice. All right, so let's dig in. At the high level, the typical process is design, permit, construct. Now, knowing this process and working with qualified professionals, not AI, not people who aren't licensed in your jurisdiction, not students who say they can make pretty drawings, is critical. Now, I know many students in AI can make beautiful renderings and drawings, but being able to draw a floor plan and knowing the code implications and requirements are two very different things. One may feel like it's saving you money up front, but it's going to cost you a lot more in liability if and when something goes wrong. When I'm talking with people who are doing adaptive reuse for the first time, there is often a misconception that construction will begin soon after they sign the architecture contract, when in reality, it can be months or even a year or more before construction starts. Because within the design process, there are typically five main phases that come after concept design. And those are schematic design, design development, construction documents, bidding, and then construction administration. Occupancy happens after construction administration is complete. The phases are sequential and they build on each other. Going step by step saves the owner design fees because the architect doesn't have to fully detail everything at the start of the project. It's cheaper, but typically not free, to change your mind during the design phases than it is during construction. Once you get past one design phase and into another, so let's say you move from schematic design into design development, making a big design change that would cause the architect to go back to the schematic design level may result in an additional service. Similarly, making changes to the design once the project gets further down the design process also will end up costing more money. The best analogy I can make for you on this is that if someone hires you to bake a cake, and you bake them that cake, and then they decide that they want a different cake, you're still going to need them to pay you for the cake that you already baked. And so that's one way to think about what happens when you make changes later in the design phase. So before the main design phases start, there's typically a pre-design phase, and that's sometimes referred to as concept design or feasibility phase. And this is where to begin if you're not sure what you want to do with your building and you want to see what's possible. So for instance, if you have a building and you're not sure if you want to turn it into housing, offices, or school, and you're curious what the return on investment or ROI would be on each of these different options, this is where doing a concept design or feasibility analysis will help you better understand what would really have the biggest impact and make the most sense for the building. This phase also typically involves all of the disciplines, so architecture, structural, mechanical, electrical, plumbing, civil, to be able to get a high-level view of what's possible with the building. For instance, this is the phase where you would want to find out, are there zoning issues that will limit how much density you can put into the building? Or are there structural systems that will need to be reinforced for new use? Are the MEP systems at the end of their service life? And all of these things are things that you'd be able to identify during the concept phase so you can plan and budget accordingly. Now, sometimes one of the questions that I get during this phase is, well, why don't we just jump straight into schematic design? And the answer for this is really, if you don't know what's possible in the building, then you're going to end up spending a lot of money in design fees figuring it out if you keep changing your mind. if you jumped right into schematic design and you told the architect to design you a school, but then you get through schematic design and you decide, you know what, actually, I want this to be a restaurant instead. Then the architect's going to have to go back to the beginning of schematic design, and you're going to end up paying for schematic design twice. Doing a concept phase allows the architect to test out a couple different options and then present you with a high-level view of what are the different pros and cons of each of the options. And then as the building owner or developer, you can decide how you want to proceed from there. So after concept design is complete and you know what you want to put into the building, this is where the architect's going to move into the first official design phase, which is schematic design, aka SD. During this phase, the architect is going to consult with the owner to determine the project goals and requirements and determine what the program is for the project. And by program, I mean the architectural program, which is the term that we use to define the required functions of the project. And so the program is typically going to include estimated square footages of each type of use and any other elements to achieve the project goals. So for instance, a developer might have done a pro forma where they want to have 10 one-bedroom units that are 700 square feet, or three office spaces that range from 300 to 600 square feet and share a 1,000 square foot conference room. So all of those types of data points are helpful for the architect during the design. And you don't necessarily need to know the exact dimensions, but giving the architect a sense of what you're looking for, what's the feeling of the space that you're going for, do you want it to be more industrial or do you want it to be more traditional? Do you want it to have a lot of ornate detailing or do you want it more modern? Those are the types of things that you would want to tell your architect starting on. And then by being able to give your architect that sort of information, then the architect can let you know, well, hey, we can fit all of these elements that you wanted into this building, but we also have this extra space that we can redesign this way or that way to provide you with more flexibility or further achieve your program goals. During schematic design, architects will typically develop diagrams, sketches, and 3D models, either physical or virtual, to illustrate the spatial relationships within the building. We also typically will work with the full design team to further research required approvals that will be needed. A lot of times during this phase, the other disciplines will provide a narrative of their design approach, not necessarily drawings, but often the narrative is enough to provide to the general contractor or whoever is going to be doing the cost estimating. But the hope is that at the end of schematic design, there will be enough information there that the owner can approve the program and that the building or the scope of the redesign could be priced to get a more accurate ballpark cost.
Want to learn more about the unknown ladies of architecture? Then I recommend you listen to She Builds Podcast, where we tell the stories of remarkable women who have shaped the design and construction industries.
Hi, I'm Jessica.
I'm Nurjiti.
And I'm Lizzie.
After we graduated from Syracuse University School of Architecture, we set out to learn and share the untold stories of women that traditional school curriculum left out.
One day, there's an announcement on campus that women had been seen wearing, quote, inappropriate clothing. Gasp!
What the heck does that mean?
Yeah, so it turns out that Ruth and her fellow classmates were these women. They had field classes where they're doing welding, forging, and foundry work, and obviously they have to wear jeans to those classes instead of, like, dresses or whatever else.
While Gertie was in school, she wasn't just going to classes, trying to stay alive like some of us. I know that was me in school, just taking it day by day.
Yes.
But not Gertie. She became the president of EVIGOL, an honorary association of Cornell women architects.
Of course she did.
These are stories not taught in schools. Women who've molded the world of architecture, construction, and development for over a century.
From Jane Jacobs to Ray Eames, She Builds Podcast explores the legacies of trailblazers. Subscribe now on your favorite podcast platform.
Let's fill the gaps in history together. All you have to do is follow the link in the show notes and subscribe and be part of a movement to expand industry narratives.
So once the cost estimate is back on the schematic design, then typically the owner will provide more guidance to the architect in terms of, is it coming in budget? Is this really in line with what the owner wants? So some of the questions that I get during this phase is, can we start construction right after this phase? And the answer is no, typically, because there's not enough detail in the schematic design documents for a contractor to build from. There's enough information in there for them to get general pricing guidance, but not enough to really put together a full construction schedule and full construction budget. There's also typically a number of reviews and approvals that are required. And during schematic design is where we're typically finding out what exactly those reviews and approvals are going to be. Because most jurisdictions will have some form of an architectural review board, or if there's a zoning or a change of use, they might have to go to some zoning board. There might be some historic requirements. And so there are a number of authorities having jurisdiction, or AHJs, that have to be consulted on most of these projects. And so typically we can't consult them until we have a sense of the proposed plans of the buildings. So we need to know what our scope is and what the desired outcome of the building is before we go to the AHJs to get approvals. All right, so after schematic design, after SD, then we move into the second design phase, which is design development, also known as DD. DD services use the initial design documents from the schematic phase and take them one step further. And so this phase is where we're going to lay out all of the mechanical, electrical, plumbing, structural systems and see how they're going to be routed through the building, as well as keep developing more of the architectural details. This phase results in drawings that often specify design elements, such as material types and locations of windows and doors. And the level of detail that's provided in this phase is typically determined by the owner's request and the project requirements. Sometimes people ask, well, why do we even need this phase? Can't we just skip it and go straight from schematic design to construction documents? And honestly, depending on the project size, sometimes you can do that. If you have a smaller project or one that's not super complicated, then sometimes you can go from schematic design to construction documents. But a lot of times, particularly on bigger projects where there needs to be any sort of community engagement, this is the phase where you're going to go to the community, if you haven't already, to really talk through what the proposal is and also get more feedback. This is also the phase where you're going to continue having those conversations with the AHJs and making sure that you are getting all of the approvals and requirements lined up that you're going to need. All right. So after we get through schematic design, SD, design development, DD, then we move on to construction documents, also known as CDs. So CDs is where the architect is going to move forward to produce drawings with greater detail. The drawings are going to include more notes, more details, more information so the building can be constructed. At the end of CDs, the architect is typically going to send the drawings to the contractor for pricing or put together a bid set to send out to a number of contractors to get multiple bids on it. Sometimes a question comes up in terms of, well, if the contractor is going to build it, why does the architect need to detail it? And this really falls into the fact that the architect has to design the building to comply with various codes and lending requirements. And to do that, we also have to detail how the building needs to come together. And so by us drawing it out to communicate to the contractor how the building needs to be constructed to comply with the codes, that eliminates confusion on the contractor side on the intent of design. When things start to get more fleshed out, and the drawings and renderings are looking more realistic, this is the phase where sometimes clients want to change their mind and do something different. And so one of the questions is, why do I need to pay an additional service if I change my mind? The building's not under construction yet. And the answer is ultimately, it takes time. One small change is going to have a ripple effect through the entire design set. Because any change that we make on the architectural plans has to be picked up by structural, electrical, mechanical, plumbing, civil, etc. And so it takes a lot of time to make sure that everything is coordinated. So let's say you see the finalized floor plan and you decide that you want the kitchen to be relocated from the front of the building to the back of the building. So architecturally, you might think, oh, just cut and paste the cabinets and things that you've already laid out and move it to the back of the building. Architecturally, that may be fine, but then structurally, things change. Plumbing has to reroute all of the piping. MEP has to figure out how they are now changing the exhaust from the front to the back. Electrical has to also deal with all of the wiring as well. And so there are a lot of ripple effects that happen. So that's part of why you end up having to pay an additional service, even though the building's not under construction yet. So building permits are typically submitted towards the end of the CD phase. Sometimes clients will want us to wait until CDs are complete to submit for building permit. Other times we'll submit for building permit when it's about 75% complete. It just depends on the jurisdiction and what's required. But after we submit for permit, then we will go into the bidding phase. And so the first step of this phase is typically going to be preparing the bid documents to go out to potential contractors for pricing. A lot of times, if you have any public funding or grants within your equity stack, you'll have to go out and invite at least 3 to 6 different contractors to bid so you can have different price comparisons. The bid set will often include an advertisement for bids, instructions to bidders, the bid form, bid documents, an owner-contractor agreement, labor material payment bond, and a lot of other necessary forms to price bids. And some projects will have unique aspects, some will have more complex ones. But typically during this phase, the architect is assisting the owner to select a contractor. The bid packages are going to get distributed, whether that's through a pre-bid meeting or an online portal or anything like that. And then the owner and architect wait for the bids to come in. A lot of times you want to give general contractors at least 4 weeks to be able to put the bids together. And that's typically 4 weeks after a pre-bid meeting or after they're able to do a site walk of the property, just to make sure that they have time to talk to their subcontractors, et cetera. And then once the bids come back in, then the owner, typically with the help of the architect, will evaluate the bids and select the winning bid. And then if there's any negotiation that needs to happen or if anything needs to get valued engineered, then that's where a lot of things can happen during this phase. At the end of bidding is typically when there would be a signed construction contract. And this phase is so important because it helps the owner get realistic prices from a number of different contractors. The architect's role in this phase is often to help answer questions from the various contractors and really help the owner make sure they get apples to apples comparisons. And it helps to manage expectations. Once you have a signed construction contract and you have an approved building permit, that's when construction can begin. And so that will move us into the fifth and final phase, which is construction administration, also known as CA. And CA services are rendered at the owner's discretion. Not every owner wants to retain the architect for CA services, but it is highly recommended to do so because the architect during this phase is the owner's set of eyes. Because there is no contractual agreement between the architect and the general contractor. The owner has a contract with the architect and the owner has a contract with the contractor, but there is no contract between the architect and the contractor. And so during this phase, the architect's core responsibility is to ensure that the contractor is building the project as specified in the construction documents and as approved by the owner. And of course, questions will likely arise on the site that will require the architect to develop architectural sketches or provide clarifications. But sometimes there may be unforeseen conditions that pop up that would require different design solutions or a change in services to complete the project. Sometimes what happens during this phase is that a project lender will request that the architect sign off on requisitions to approve the funding that the contractor is asking for. The contractor has to provide information about how complete construction is, and then the architect goes around and confirms that. So let's say the contractor says that 100% of the windows have been installed, but then the architect goes out to site and sees that only 20% of the windows have been installed. Then the architect would advise the owner not to pay the 100% and only pay the 20%, and the requisition would be adjusted. And for projects that are going after historic tax credits, having the architect or the historic tax credit consultant on board during this phase is incredibly important to make sure that there's observation occurring and so that the construction proceeds as it was approved in the part two. Reminder that historic tax credits are voluntary. And so if construction proceeds in a way that negatively impacts the historic tax credit, then the historic tax credit could be at risk of being lost. But getting into how historic tax credits overlay within the design phases is a whole nother episode. All right, to recap, while every project is unique, the design process is not. It's a process that is followed to get reliable results and to make sure things happen in the right order. So that's all for this week. I hope this answered some of your questions and you have a better understanding of the design process. You now know that the process is to go from schematic design to design development to construction documents to bidding and wrapping it up with construction administration before you occupy the building. Thank you so much for listening. Links to amazing resources can be found in the episode's show notes. Special thanks to Sarah Gilberg for allowing me to use snippets of her song Fireflies from her debut album, Other People's Secrets, which, by the way, is available wherever music is sold. If you haven't already, be sure to subscribe to the show. And now that Tangible Remnants is part of the Gable Media Network, you can listen and subscribe to all network partner content at gablemedia.com. That's GABLmedia.com. Until next time. Remember that historic preservation is a present conversation with our past about our future. We don't inherit the earth from our parents, but we borrow it from our children. So let's make sure we're telling our inclusive history.
I saw the first fireflies of summer, and right then I thought of you. Oh, I could see us catching them and setting them free. Honey, that's what you do. That's what you do to me.